Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. At some point during the last several years, you may have sensed that there were fewer and fewer insects colliding into your car windshield or buzzing around streetlights in the night. If you have noticed, you're hardly alone. The feeling has become so common, entomologists have dubbed it the windshield phenomenon. Insect populations are in decline all over the world, with some species losing as much as 90% of their members. But what does that mean for life on Earth? That's a question journalist Brooke Jarvis explored in her November 27th New York Times Magazine article, "The Insect Apocalypse Is Here." She's an award-winning contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, the California Sunday Magazine. She's written for The New Yorker, Wired, GQ, and Harper's. And she joins us now, along with Dr. Arthur Shapiro, professor of evolution and ecology at the University of California, Davis, and Dr. David Wagner, professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Connecticut. Welcome all to our show.
Thank you for inviting us.
Dr. Shapiro, many of us use the words bug and insect interchangeably. Are they the same thing?
Bugs, properly defined, are a subset of insects belonging to one particular order. But I have to confess that in my communications with my research associates, I refer to butterflies as bugs. I'm not worried about it.
But true bugs are only the ones that have tube-like mouths for piercing and sucking?
Yeah, and they have other anatomical characteristics that define them as the order Hemiptera. So they include various plant pests. They include bed bugs.
And Dr. Wagner, many of them cause disease, they destroy crops, we all hate cockroaches. A lot of people think of insects as something to squish as quickly as possible. What roles do they play in our world?
Well, they're very important in pollination. There's quite a bit of concern now about the loss of pollinators. There are places in China where humans have to do the pollination with little brushes, but they're enormously important there. But I think the thing that really affects a lot of people would be that they're just sort of the hamburger or the absolute fabric that we tether almost all of the food webs together on land. So all these birds are dependent on them and all these mammals. And, you know, spring would be silent if it weren't for our songbirds, which are highly insect dependent. So they are important in recycling. And I think in part of the human future, they're going to be in part of our food, actually. Because they're so low on the food chain, they're loaded in protein, but also very efficient to grow. And I think that human diets will include more insects as we move into the future.
And people in some cultures around the world do eat insects. Hasn't your focus been largely on caterpillars and moths? Is that what's called Lepidoptera?
Yeah, so I study caterpillars, which is the early stage of a moth or a butterfly, and they really are the most important or the most abundant biomass in our forests anywhere along the East Coast. And again, if you need or you want to hear a baby bird, the way you make a baby bird is you find caterpillars, or the parents have to find caterpillars, and that's how you build a nestling.
Brooke, what got you interested in this topic? Brooke, are you there?
Yes, I am. I had seen some of the studies that had been coming out in recent years, and even though they were getting a lot of news attention, I think that we have a habit of seeing bad news about the environment and moving past it too quickly, not spending enough time to think about what it really means. And I was interested in the questions that scientists were asking about insect decline and the degree and what it would mean the world that I wanted to you know, to spend a lot more time diving into that, because I think that insects are sort of indicative of how we view the environment in general, many of the problems happening around us. They're so common and sort of invisible, we take them for granted, and it's hard to see the changes that are happening in the environment. And that was one of the articles that really interested me, the extent to which we notice what we're actually doing to the planet.
Dr. Shapiro, what were some of the first signs that we're facing what's been called an insect apocalypse?
Well, it's an interesting story. You may have heard the adage that the plural of anecdote is not data. The problem is that we had zillions of anecdotes of insect decline, but we had no systematic, authoritative documentation of decline, which is something that requires systematic monitoring. Somebody has to actually be keeping a long-running data set quantifying the number of insects of whatever group in a particular place, and people are just not doing that. What crystallized this in the minds of scientists was a particular study carried out by an entomological society in a place called Krefeld in Germany. And they found such dramatic declines in insect biomass as the actual bulk of insects in the area where they were monitoring, that it caught everyone's attention. It was the kind of data set we needed as a wake-up.
Now, apocalypse is a strong word. Brooke, how many insects has the world lost?
It's really impossible to say. Insects to begin with. It is a strong word. And it's interesting because, you know, this is such a, in some ways, a new study. The data, as Dr. Shapiro was just saying, that scientists wish they had, they largely don't have. So the extent to which this is happening. But all of the information, or the agreement you have, is extremely troubling. And it's time to not only figure out what's happening, but action.
Now, Dr. Shapiro mentioned the Krefeld study. Was that done by scientists?
Oh, which of us are you asking?
Well, you know, I'm going to throw questions out to all of you.
Okay.
And you just, because you all know the answers to these questions.
Okay, well, I will chip in and say that the Krefeld study was done by the local entomological society. There are societies or clubs of insect people all over the world, and they usually consist of a mix of professionals and amateurs. And these folks in Krefeld decided for their own reasons to monitor the insect populations in a nature preserve area. And there are other long-term studies which have now all been put into contact with one another as a reaction to the Krefeld study.
But they were amateurs, in effect?
Some are amateurs, and in fact, it's interesting. We are losing our expertise in natural history at the professional level. That is to say, here at University of California, Davis, for example, we get all these brilliant students who come in to get advanced degrees, and they are all well acquainted with the theoretical issues in biology. They're acquainted with the mathematical and statistical techniques. But if they want to get an experimental system or a study system out there in the real world, nowadays, they have to go to the experienced amateurs, the bird watchers, the butterfly collectors, because those are the people who really know the beasts. We're not training specialists in the biology of particular groups of organisms the way we used to at the professional level.
And why is that?
So, yes, we're increasingly dependent on amateurs.
Why is that? Have scientists...
Well, it's a number of things. For one thing, one learned those skills by apprenticeship. You teamed up with an old pro and followed him or her around and saw what he or she did. And the old pros are dying off. They're not being replaced. The prestige, the status within the scientific community tends to attach to the idea people more than the empiricists. And that's a real problem. If you have a vacancy on the faculty in a biology department, there is a great tendency to go for somebody who has a big reputation as an idea person, not as a person who spends 300 days a year out watching ants.
Brooke, you write that the decline was felt more than documented. And the windshield phenomenon was a factor. Who came up with that term?
I don't think that it traces to any one specific person. I think that this was such a common experience that people had and that they reported to entomologists that it became the place. And there's other forms of it. You know, sometimes people notice this on their car windshield. Sometimes they notice that, you know, gosh, I remember there being a lot of moths around the streetlight, and now I don't see that. One of the scientists I interviewed had someone come up to him and in the 70s was to work at a car wash and remove all of the bugs from cars that the machines couldn't get. And I think people have so much interest in this topic because they have such a personal connection to it. Most of us can't see all of the, for example, the ramifications of climate change. Some of them we certainly can, but some we simply read about in studies and get worried. But they're all around us. They're living. And to not only to see them disappear, as the east that was happening, I think that's something that is very compelling to people because it makes us think of
again
happening the planet that we may not be noticing.
Again, I grew up in the Philadelphia area, and as a teenager, when I wanted to collect insects, I went out to a rural gas station, you know, lights out in the middle of the boonies, darkness all around, this brilliant light at the gas station, and I could get everything I wanted there. When I first came out here to California in the winter of 71-72, I was delighted to see that that was the case here. It's not anymore. You can go to a gas station here in the Central Valley and get nothing at all, even at the what should be the peak season. The change is really drastic.
I'm speaking on Leonard Lopate at Large today with Drs. Arthur Shapiro and David Wagner and with journalist Brooke Jarvis, whose article in the November 27th New York Times Magazine, The Insect Apocalypse is Here, inspired this segment. Dr. Wagner, are specific species of insects declining or are insects in general declining? Have we lost Dr. Wagner? Okay, well, we're going to get him back. Meanwhile, Brooke, who is Suna Bove-Reese, and why is he nostalgic about bugs in mouth? I think we're having a problem with all of our calls. You are listening to WBAI. Hello? Well... I think, well, why don't we play a little music or something? I don't know what to do here. When we're reliant on three telephones. And one of the reasons that, well, let me talk a bit about why we are coming to you as listeners and asking you to support WBAI, because we don't accept advertising or corporate underwriting of any kind, and we rely totally on the financial support of our listeners. And sometimes that means that we don't always have enough money to keep up the basic things like the equipment. We do have to pay for our phone bill. We do have to pay for all sorts of other things. But as you can hear, right now we are struggling a bit, and we would hope that you would give us a show of support so we can actually do the kinds of shows that we dream of doing, we envision doing. If you could give us a call now, make a donation, show your support for the programming that we bring you every weekday on Leonard Lopate at Large, we really would appreciate it. Please give whatever amount you're comfortable with, because it all helps us to keep bringing you the one-hour deep dive interviews that you get on this show. And we hope you'll become a sustaining member of Leonard Lopate at Large at the monthly sustaining level of $10 or more, in which case we'd be happy to say thank you with a free one-year subscription to Mother Jones, one of the leading progressive publications with its focus on political commentary and investigative reporting. It's our way of saying thanks for helping to support Leonard Lopate at Large, and your donation will automatically be deducted from your checking or credit card account. So give us that call, 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Or go to givetowbai.org. That's give and then the number 2, wbai.org. And please be sure to note that your membership is in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. It's a way of supporting this show and everything that you hear on BAI. Are we okay, Reggie?
Yeah.
I want to get back to our guests. And I think I was asking Dr. Wagner whether there are specific species of insects that are in decline, or are insects in general declining?
Well, at this point, we're still collecting the data, and that's really a point that we need to emphasize here. We don't really know the spatial extent, and we don't know the timeline of the declines. We have really well-documented declines in Northern Europe, both from England and Germany, and these are two of the areas of the world that have the greatest density of naturalists, or the amateurs that we were just speaking about. And they pretty much look at more charismatic things, so they'll be looking at butterflies and moths and maybe bees and charismatic groups of beetles. We are knowing or seeing that there's pretty good evidence for declines in butterflies, and that nearly a third to maybe even a half of the butterflies of Northern Europe are declining, and many of these are now extirpated. Many of the moths the same way. And again, we worry about this. Perhaps if you don't like insects, that's one issue, but you have to worry about all the animals that need those butterflies and moths to continue their journey on this planet as well. And we keep coming back to birds, particularly songbirds, and a particularly important, endearing group of organisms that will suffer if moths and butterflies are declining. Around the world, there's pretty good evidence that some pollinators, particularly bumblebees, are in decline. And so those are perhaps the most well-studied groups at this point.
Dr. Shapiro, you've written about the insect/host-plant interactions. Right now, aren't invasive species also playing a role in all of that?
Well, my take on that may not be typical of what you hear. That is to say, we have been very interested in the use of introduced, I'll avoid the word invasive for right now, introduced species as resources by native insects, which is a very, very common phenomenon. There is a lot of arm-waving, a lot of panic that so-called invasive species are wreaking havoc on ecosystems, when in fact many of them are inserting themselves not only harmlessly but possibly beneficially into those ecosystems. The famous tropical ecologist Dan Jansen coined the term ecological fitting for the phenomenon where a species with no history in a particular place or community is introduced and fits right in and, in effect, is accepted by the species already there as a resource, something that can be utilized. And this can set off a whole train of evolutionary interactions between species. So I'm not that concerned about invasive species, except for those that cause direct economic or public health harm. In fact, we have some dramatic cases in which introduced species have been the salvation of endangered native species by replacing resources that they were dependent on that are now disappearing with abundant resources that they can switch on to.
We are spraying pesticides almost indiscriminately. That's killing off a lot of insects. And Taffy Williams, a listener, wrote in to request that I ask all of you about the impact of Wi-Fi radiation on bees, butterflies, and other insects. She said she's been reading a number of studies on that.
In a nutshell, we know absolutely nothing about that.
You were going to say something, Dr. Wagner?
Yeah, I mean, I have Wi-Fi in my lab, and I rear about maybe 1,000 or 2,000 species of insects a year in the lab, and I haven't noticed any inexplicable mortality in the lab. In terms of this decline, I think we have to leave all things on the table, but I would be very surprised that Wi-Fi were an issue, but potentially, I guess, like Dr. Shapiro says, anything is possible at this point, but I would also say that the pattern of decline, where we're seeing the decline, where it's documented, doesn't really line up with something like Wi-Fi. The worst declines that we're seeing are areas with very high human occupation, like England and northwestern Germany. And also now in New England, we're seeing areas that have really diminished faunas, both in terms of numbers of individuals and kinds, numbers of species. But it doesn't necessarily line up with something like Wi-Fi. At least if I were a detective and trying to solve this mystery, it seems to be more patchy.
Now, you're the author of a book called Caterpillars of Eastern North America, Identification and Natural History. Are they any more endangered than caterpillars in other parts of the world?
Well, I would say the strongest thing that's changed or the most obvious signal of decline in New England would be the giant silk moth. So in New England, we had maybe 12 to 14 species, and we've lost four of those over the last, since the 1950s, in the last seven decades or something. So we're seeing sort of a steady decline in numbers and, again, also the loss of species.
Now, why would be concerned about the loss of silk moths?
Well, I'm not talking about necessarily the individual importance of a given taxon or a given lineage on this planet. Although, in the case of silk moths, I actually think there were specialized birds that liked large insects and may, I don't know if they specialized on giant silk moths, but they certainly included them in their diet. And whippoorwills were a bird that nearly everybody heard and loved in the 1950s and 60s. But when's the last time you heard a whippoorwill if you lived in New England? And these are birds that would sit on the ground and look up into the sky at twilight and eat and look for large insects like silk moths. So this is a loss, a faunal loss, that could be linked to this decline in insects. But silk moths are actually great, big, beautiful insects with wingspans of 4, even 5 inches that people find particularly beautiful. I mean, the Luna moth might be the most beautiful invertebrate in all of New England, and its numbers aren't what they used to be. And so it goes for many of our larger insects.
No.
I'll interject here, if I may,
please,
that those very big, showy, beautiful giant silk moths and their very big caterpillars traditionally have been an entree to natural history for kids, even in the city. When I was a kid in Philadelphia, we reared those things in classrooms all the time, and it was never difficult to get them. You could get the cocoons off street trees, and the moths would emerge in the classroom, and everyone would ooh and ah. And we would get the eggs, and we would rear the caterpillars. And I don't know what percentage of my year class of natural historians got into it as a result of exposure to those things. But I would guess it's a non-trivial percentage.
I noticed this year alone, I have milkweed planted near my home. Last year, I had a lot of monarch butterflies. This year, hardly any. So obviously, it isn't just a matter of not having milkweed. Something else is going on.
That's a bad sign when you're losing monarchs this year, because this is a better year than most. So they're down, their numbers, they say, are down about 90% from where they were 20 or 30 years ago. And so they're one of the bellwethers, or the canary in the coal mine, of this insect decline phenomenon. So what's happening with the monarch may mirror some of the other species that are less well known. But I would, that kind of report that you're sharing is alarming, and that's the kind of thing that we have to collect more data in order to solve this mystery.
Because we're involved in monarch monitoring, I can tell you that it actually is a quite good monarch year in most of the eastern United States. Not near your house, but in fact we have excellent reports of numbers from upstate New York, from New England, from the upper Midwest. But it is the worst monarch year on record, we believe, in California. In the entire year, being out in the field for about 230 days this year, I have seen a grand total of, let me just check, I have the numbers right here, only about 20 adult monarchs in the entire year, and I have not seen a single caterpillar in the field. And that is a catastrophic decline. That is a totally unprecedented decline.
Brooke, you write that there are over 12,000 types of ants, nearly 20,000 varieties of bees, almost 400,000 species of beetles. Were you surprised by the level of diversity? Isn't the geneticist J.B.S. Haldane supposed to have said that the creator must have had an inordinate fondness for beetles?
There are an incredible number of beetles and an incredible number of all of these species. And that explains in part why it's so difficult to say in really broad strokes what's happening. You know, we have very specific numbers about species like monarchs, but only about 2%, I believe, of invertebrate species have been studied enough to even have estimates of their conservation status from IUCN. So in other words, not only do we not know whether they might be going extinct, we don't know enough about those species to know, you know, what their role in ecosystems are, what they're doing for the plants and the soil and the other animals in which they are enmeshed in food webs, including us. So it's, you know, that's another way in which insects reveal both how large and complicated the natural world is and how difficult it can be to track the way it's changing.
Well, science,
we were talking earlier... Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
That we were talking earlier about mechanisms, what may be causing insect declines. And one of the scientists that I spoke to used a phrase that has stuck with me, that they're responding to the transformation of the world. And that simply means, you know, what aren't they reacting to? There are pesticides and herbicides in their environment that they're not evolved to deal with. There is urban sprawl and expansion of humans' places that squeeze out the places where insects used to live. An interesting thing that a lot of people emphasized is that with the increasing efficiency of agriculture and industrial agriculture, you no longer really have any weeds in the field or along the edges of the field. You don't have hedgerows. So these were what to us as people seem like really insignificant little bits of habitat.
And then we have large lawns, and we have highways that cut across expanses of where insects might want to live. We're doing everything possible to kill off our insect population just by creating a modern civilization?
We're certainly creating a world that's very different from the one that insects are used to. So it wouldn't be surprising that they are reacting in unexpected ways.
Now, scientists have named and described a million species of insects. Is that the majority of them?
We all spoke. I would guess that there's 6 to 7 times that many.
Really?
And that tropical areas are particularly unknown, and it's a shame because tropical deforestation is probably eliminating species at this point much faster than scientists are describing them.
Let me give you an anecdote that illustrates how little we know. Once upon a time, I was on a long-haul bus crossing the Patagonian steppe. And this is an area where nobody ever collects. And the bus broke down, and we were stuck there in the middle of no place for 3 hours while the driver and his assistant tried to repair it. So being an entomologist, I took my net and I walked around always keeping the bus in sight so if they got started, I could run back and get on. So I had plenty of time to collect, and I collected, and I discovered 3 species of butterflies on that afternoon that were completely unknown to science. That gives you an idea how much we know.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large. The insect apocalypse is here, and two of the scientists who she cites and who are engaged in looking into the situation, Dr. David Wagner, professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Connecticut, and Dr. Arthur Shapiro, a professor of evolution and ecology at the University of California. Dr. Shapiro, in the United States, one of the few long-term data sets about insect abundance comes from you. Didn't you originally plan on studying how short-term weather variations affected butterfly populations?
Hired at UC Davis as an assistant professor, I knew I had a timeline to either achieve tenure or not.
This is 1972?
Yeah, 71-72, the winter of 71-72. And I had this project completely mapped out, and I figured I've got 5 years to get a reasonable data set that can be analyzed statistically. And if they boot me out, well, at least I've got a nice marketable study there. And they didn't boot me out, and as it happened, the climate became exceedingly unpredictable, and the data were too good to stop collecting them. And so I'm now concluding year 47 of that study.
And what can you tell us about butterfly populations as a result of that 47-year study? That's in the Central Valley and the Sierras?
That's correct. And it's a very complicated story, but in a nutshell, around 1998-1999, the low-elevation butterfly fauna here in the Central Valley went in the tank. There was a drastic decline at that time, and there's been slight recovery. The recovery that has happened, interestingly enough, occurred during our millennial 5-year drought. And since the drought ended, things have gone back in the toilet. In the mountains, there was little decline, and what there was associated with climate change until very recently, and the drought provoked severe decline. I can explain the reasons, but you probably don't want me to go into all of that. Provoked severe decline in the mountain butterfly fauna, which is now in bad shape. So we now have severe declines in the butterfly faunas at all elevations.
What's the impact of the fires in California been?
Only very local. Obviously, butterflies, like everything else that's carbon-based, are in trouble if they're caught in an actual fire. But the total acreage that's burned is not all that great, and there's no evidence that the smoke has caused any harm. Interestingly enough, after a fire, in wildland, you typically get a tremendous bloom of plants because the fire recycles the nutrients that had been tied up in the plants that burned. And as a result, you get all this new growth, and very commonly you get a big outbreak of insect abundance a year or two after a fire because of all these resources.
Now, Dr. Wagner, do we know why insect populations are in decline? You mentioned,
well, that's the,
we mentioned agriculture.
Well, the $20,000 question is, you know, what's going on in Griswold? And so there's over 130 of these amateur professionals that Dr. Shapiro was talking about that have been involved, that are currently involved in that Griswold study, and then maybe an equal number of people that are doing insect monitoring in England, and nobody has a single explanation, and that's the scary part. So here you have 2 widespread declines, and they're among flying insects, different lineages that go clear back to the Permian, the pre-dinosaur times, and we're seeing declines across those different limbs of the tree of life, and nobody has a really good explanation. And so there's climate change, there's invasive species, there's habitat destruction, there's light pollution, there's car strikes. We talk about the windshield effect, but it could be the actual windshields of our car that are playing a role.
What about neonicotinoids and neurotoxins?
Neonicotinoids.
Forgive me for mispronouncing it.
It's a new type of pesticide that is called a systemic, where the pesticide, rather than being sprayed on the leaves or the fruits, as you would normally do with old pesticides, these are actually put into the seeds or put into the plant tissues. And so every tissue, even the pollen that blows off the plant, becomes toxic to insects. And so there's quite a bit of concern about these neonics. They're being used quite widely. And so some of the decline may be linked to those. But I'll also say that we're seeing declines before those pesticides were ever developed and in places where neonics are not being used. Europe is about to ban or has banned all neonics, so we'll have to see if that has any effect on this decline. I'm afraid the story is not that simple, and I think there's an awful lot of smart people involved here that have not come up with a single cause, and I'm scared to death that the cause is actually death by a thousand cuts and not any...
Yeah, but
any one factor.
But the present administration has been cutting back on regulations of these sorts of things. So does that mean we'll probably see more of a decline, just as a matter of course?
Well, the pesticides are at the root of it. Absolutely, there's no denying that. And so, actually, there's one phenomenon that we haven't mentioned here in this conversation that I think may play a very significant role, and that would be the phenomenon of agricultural intensification. We've gone from very small localized family farms in, say, the 1950s, and this would be the same in New England as it is in Germany and possibly even California, where these were more nature-friendly farms. They had hedgerows. They had lightly grazed pasture lands with wet meadows, flowers, commonly across these fields. Great habitat for butterflies, but we've moved from those to mega farms and much more agriculturally intense applications of genetic engineering, herbicide application, pesticide, routine scheduled pesticide use in over tens of hundreds of acres. And so we've got away from the family farm, and so agriculture has become nature unfriendly, and I think that could be playing a pretty important role in all of this, but to what extent, I can't say.
California Central Valley is really the cradle of industrial-scale corporate agriculture in the United States, and we've been that way for a long time. Apropos neonicotinoids, our lab was one of two, the other being in the UK, that published statistical data demonstrating a temporal and spatial correlation of butterfly declines with neonics. Remember, I said that we had a decline in 1999, and that coincides in time with the first widespread application of neonics here. It's obviously much more complicated than neonics, but the statistics both in the UK and here suggest that they are a component in it.
Scientists have identified five great extinction events over the course of the history of our planet. Are we being alarmist if we wonder whether this is the start of the sixth extinction?
Well, we're definitely looking down the chute of the sixth extinction. We've lost a lot of large mammals already. I don't think there's any denying that we are. And so the only issue on the table is the rate of decline. So there's always been extinction on our planet. 99.9% of all species have already gone extinct. So extinction isn't really the issue. The issue for us is the rate of extinction. And so we are looking at a situation where the rate is as high as it's ever been. And that's why we're looking at something called the Anthropocene, or the sixth great extinction. If insects are in essentially an apocalypse situation, then you're talking about something entirely unprecedented. Now, I'm hoping that apocalypse is too strong a word. I'm hoping that the places the insects are going extinct are places with very high human density or human activities, and that this is not a global phenomenon. That's what we don't know. That's the data that we need to collect. There was a recent report out of Puerto Rico claiming a very high rate of decline in Puerto Rico. That's very scary, hyper-alarming.
As a result of the hurricane?
I really know.
This is before the hurricane.
The data was gathered in, I think, 2013.
Now, Brooke, you write about the value of abundance. What do you mean by that?
I think it's something that is often... Right, that is often overlooked in conservation circles. We think about extinction and we think about the final loss of certain species of animals. And we do think about these charismatic megafauna like tigers. But we feel a little comforted because tigers have not gone extinct. We've gone to a lot of trouble to conserve tigers and they continue. But what we forget is that they're now only living in a few isolated pockets. In the case of tigers, I think they've lost 93% of their range. So, yes, we still have tigers, but you have to think of, these 93% of places that once had them that are tigerless, and what does it mean to those places? And I used, that as an example in the article because it's a little easier to understand the impact of large species who have an outsized effect on the ecosystems in which they live. They connect them to other ecosystems, even their, by pooping and eating, they have a huge effect on the ecosystem.
Simply by walking and from one place to the other.
What is a trophic cascade,
and how does that apply?
Maybe one of the scientists should take that, actually.
Okay.
Well, a trophic cascade we have food webs on the planet. Everybody understands food webs, but it'd be when you bring about one change to one entity in that food web, where the effects of that change cascade out and affect players that are more remote or dependent species, or maybe species that are dependent on the ones that get affected through this cascade. So you have, it's basically a rippling effect that moves outward. And the most famous example in it is the sea otters off the Pacific coast. The fishermen would shoot the sea otters because the sea otters were eating their fish, and it seemed like a great idea. But the sea otters actually were eating sea urchins, and the sea urchins were a key component of this marine ecosystem where these fishermen were trying to fish. And what happened was because the sea otters weren't eating sea urchins, the sea urchins exploded, and they ate all the kelp. And so these kelp forests that were the underwater nurseries for the fish that these fishermen were trying to fish for disappeared, and so did the fish. And as a consequence, there's this cascading phenomena of loss just because of removal of one keystone species. This would be the sea otter in this case, but in a terrestrial forest, it could be a very common caterpillar.
So note that everything is interconnected,
you're saying.
Note that a trophic cascade can go either way. It can go top down from the predators down through the system, or it can go from the bottom up, like the insects, as food for things higher up in the system. So either way, manipulating the system can have catastrophic, unexpected effects.
Scientists talk about functional versus numerical extinction. What's the difference?
Numerical extinction would...
Go ahead.
The last northern white rhino disappears, and it's the very last. That species and all of its genetic material is gone from the earth. But functional extinction is what already exists in the majority of the habitats where that animal once lived, meaning that there are no rhinos there to affect the ecosystem. And there's some interesting studies coming out about the ways that, animals don't have to be, not only do they not have to be entirely removed from the ecosystem, they can just have diminished abundance, and it can still have enormous knock-on effects on other species that are connected to them through, a variety of ecological interactions.
Well, a great example of functional extinction is on the Indian Ocean island of Mauritius. Everybody knows about the dodo bird, but probably most people don't know that there is a tree. Its scientific name is Calvaria, which apparently depended on the dodo for its seed dispersal. The dodos would eat the fruit, pass the seeds through in their dung, and that treatment inside the bird was necessary to germinate the seeds after they were dispersed in the dung. So since the extinction of the dodo, there's nobody functionally to disperse Calvaria, and presumably it will eventually die out.
A 2013 paper in Nature, which modeled both natural and computer-generated food webs, suggested that a loss of even 30% of a species' abundance can be so destabilizing that other species start going fully numerically extinct.
Yeah, that's a very interesting study.
So that's only 30%. That means that 70% are still around, but the impact can be really dire.
Right. So I guess a really important point of Brooks' article was this idea that declines in abundance are ecologically important. So conservation biologists, rare species biologists for years, have been focusing on these taxa, these entities, these birds, butterflies, that are sort of ecologically unimportant because they're so scarce or so numerically reduced that whether or not they disappear or stay is mostly about ethics and aesthetics and that sort of thing. And we paid very little attention to things decreasing in abundance. There were too many other problems, but really, if you take something that was present by the millions and you knock it down to even 200,000, it seems like, well, we still have plenty. We have 200,000. But at the time that there were a million of these things, then that organism, let's say it was a caterpillar, would be enormously important to feeding the rodents, potentially even bears, birds, and other being a part of recycling, macro decomposition in that forest. It could be important in many, many ways. When things are abundant, they're ecologically important. Then they're providing ecosystem services, whether that's cleaning air, cleaning water, being a part of food webs, removing dung, removing carrion. Those are the ecological services that nature provides for human and for other nature. And it's when you have the decline, the diminishment of these superabundant organisms that really shouldn't even be on the target of a conservation biologist or rare species biologist, that becomes functional importance. And that's the kind of thing that Brooks' article was trying to draw attention to, that biologists now have to look at a new phenomenon and something that's very, very important. You could call it defaunation.
Brooke, you would are the world's governments aware of the crisis at hand? You would think that there'd be a UN commission that would be engaged in talking about this the way they're talking about climate change.
Well, are we engaged enough on climate change is another question.
There was a report from the UN. That doesn't mean that every country is going to abide
by its
findings.
Right, it doesn't mean that governments are taking it seriously. In some places, you know, Europe is getting pretty concerned about this. There have been hearings in the EU Parliament, and Germany has been having hearings. One of the scientists I interviewed in the Netherlands the day I walked into his office, he had met that morning with the King of the Netherlands about, in part, the city's effort to make its riverside more bug-friendly. And it's great to see that in Europe. You definitely don't see a comparative interest in the U.S. In many other countries, we don't have, as we've mentioned before, Europe tends to have the best data about insects, in part because of the history of naturalism.
But as was mentioned earlier, in the Mauxian Valley in China, shortages of insect pollinators have led farmers to hire human workers to replace bees. So each person has to cover 5 to 10 trees a day pollinating apple blossoms by hand. And that was done for us by bees in the past. Can we expect something similar to happen in the United States?
I think that it's well, I mean, we do have, for example, the almond harvest is supported by the transport of, I don't know off the top of my head, but something like 3/4 of the nation's bees go to California for 2 weeks in February to pollinate the almonds.
Mm-hmm.
It's a massive undertaking. Sometimes you hear about it in the news because there's a semi-truck full of bees that overturns on the highway. But it's an example of the kinds of ecosystem services that Dr. Wagner was talking about that are often invisible until they're not being fulfilled.
Now, the bees are brought there. They're not. They don't go there on their own.
Right, they're brought there
on semis. Yeah.
Another example in the article is about how Australia had a big national effort to import dung beetles because the local dung beetles were evolved to eat marsupial poop, which is pretty different from cow poop. And so they just weren't eating it when cows were imported to Australia, or at least not quickly enough. So that's the kind of service that happens invisibly and we don't think about until all of a sudden the cow feces is just sitting around for months or years. And then you notice.
I'm throwing this out to doctors Wagner and Shapiro. Can you give our listeners any reasons to be hopeful? Insects are prolific breeders. Can their populations bounce back?
Well, I'll give you a California example.
Go ahead.
Okay, so first Dr. Shapiro and then Dr. Wagner. Go ahead.
Okay. As I mentioned, we had severe butterfly declines before the recent drought. And to most people's surprise, those were reversed substantially during the drought. It looked as if the decreases were going to continue indefinitely, and things looked very grim. And then, remarkably, the butterfly faunas that I monitor in the Central Valley bounced back to the levels they had been at in the 70s and 80s. As soon as the drought ended, they began to decline again, and we're very intensely trying to understand why that happened. But the fact that it did happen suggests that the losses are not necessarily so deep-rooted as to be irreversible.
Should we just be planting more milkweed and resist swatting flies?
There's no good evidence that there is a milkweed shortage. There certainly isn't in California.
I think that we could be more nature-friendly in how we landscape our yards. I think that that has tremendous value to bring nature back to our landscaping. I think agriculture could be made more nature-friendly. I think there's big pushes to do this in Europe at this point in time. There's the potential that we could do this in the Midwest and in the Central Valley of California, where we could have hedgerows and we could have buffer zones. Insects have tremendous capacity for increase. So the average clutch size of an insect might be, or at least the fecundity, a female insect can produce 100 to 200 or 300 eggs. So their ability to spring back if conditions return to, you know, those that are more favorable are tremendous, much more than they would be for a tiger or an endangered bird or mammals. So I think there's reason to be hopeful. I also think that this whole phenomenon is tainted a little bit, or at least biased a little bit, towards the worst-case scenarios. That's where we have the data at this point in time. But we really have to collect more data, and we have to understand where this decline is happening. We don't know that it's happening all over the world. There are places that are more nature-friendly with lower human population densities where the insects could be doing reasonably well. So we really don't know. So I am hopeful that that places that are not, you know, used, you know, in an intense fashion the way agriculture has done in the Midwest of the U.S. will still have intact populations. We'll still have pollinators to pollinate our flowers. We're still going to have songbirds singing in the spring.
But economics has driven people in Africa, Asia, Central and South America to destroy rainforests. So it looks like the process will be continuing, and it's a way of satisfying human needs.
Well, there's no question that rainforest destruction and habitat conversion is probably the number one enemy of wildlife, whether you're talking about insects or any kind of bird or turtle or anything else that you might want or love or appreciate if you love nature. And so degradation, whether it's for agriculture or human buildings, is really a big issue and maybe the globally most important conservation concern or challenge going forward. And that may be only second to all the carbon that's in the atmosphere. There's no question that climate change is going to be driving waves of extinction, perhaps not because of simple changes in temperature like 2 degrees or 4 degrees centigrade, but because of the variance that's going to happen with the climate. We're going to have much more severe storms. We're going to have more droughts. With those droughts, we're going to have more fires. But I would say carbon in the atmosphere and habitat destruction are probably the two greatest challenges to humanity and the two greatest challenges to nature going forward.
I've been speaking with Dr. Arthur Shapiro, Professor of Evolution Ecology, University of California, Davis, and David Wagner, Professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology of the University of Connecticut, and Brooke Jarvis, whose article in the November 27th issue of the New York Times Magazine, The Insect Apocalypse Is Here, inspired this segment. Thank you all.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
And that brings us to the end of the show. My great thanks to Brooke Jarvis, Drs. Arthur Shapiro, and David Wagner, to Susie Stoltz, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who helps things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.